Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be speaking today with Jed Rakoff, federal district judge for the Southern District of New York, about his new book, Why the Innocent Plead Guilty and the Guilty Go Free. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Today's guest, Federal Judge Jed Rakoff, makes clear that the criminal justice system in the United States bears little relationship to what the Founding Fathers contemplated, what the media portrays, or what the average American believes. He asks questions like, how can we be proud of a system of justice that often pressures the innocent to plead guilty? How can we claim that justice is equal when we imprison thousands of poor black men for relatively modest crimes, but rarely prosecute rich white executives who commit crimes that have far greater impact? What Rakoff terms our broken legal system, like our healthcare system, our education system, our immigration system, fails to fulfill its purpose or serve society. The difference being that unlike those others, our legal system is not nearly as examined, questioned, or discussed. Not only that, like the other systems I mentioned, I bet that most Americans might tell you the U.S. has the greatest justice system in the world. Far from it. I was excited to learn of Judge Rakoff's book and eager to speak with him today. Jed Rakoff has served since 1996 as a federal district judge for the Southern District of New York. He's authored over 1,500 judicial opinions, co-authored 5 books, and is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. Judge Rakoff, who earned his BA from Swarthmore College, a Master of Philosophy from Oxford, and a JD from Harvard Law, is a commissioner on the National Commission on Forensic Science and served as co-chair of the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Eyewitness Identification. The book we're going to talk about today is Why the Innocent Plead Guilty and the Guilty Go Free and Other Paradoxes of Our Broken Legal System. Welcome, Jed Rakoff, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to have been invited to participate.
And I'm going to tell listeners we're recording this conversation Tuesday, June 15th. So my first question these days is, how are you? How have you coped with the pandemic? You, your loved ones?
Well, reasonably well. No one in my family has caught the virus. The most interesting thing is I think I'm one of very few judges who has conducted jury trials in my court during the pandemic. I've had 3 and I'm starting a 4th one tomorrow. This has been very good for my ego, because I like to see that courts can at least continue to function even under the crisis situations that we've had. Nevertheless, of course, many courts are unable to function during this period, or only function in civil matters, not in criminal matters, and that's been most unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. And I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Can you share a bit about how you see your personal path to the work you do today? And feel free to go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Well, if I go real back, I go to my mother, who was an absolutely super brilliant person who suffered gender discrimination throughout much of her own life, but it never embittered her, but it certainly made me aware from early on how many injustices existed in our society. I also had the great privilege to go to Swarthmore College in the early 1960s, when the civil rights movement was really gaining steam. I participated in a little way myself, but many of my classmates were freedom fighters and otherwise deeply involved in that movement, and that was also had a great impact on me. And then I had two ambitions. One was to become a trial lawyer, and the other was to write musical comedies. And I had actually written several during law school that were performed and at least my mother loved. So I had the very naive idea that I would come to New York, and during the day I would work in a big law firm, and in the evening I would write the Great American Musical. What I didn't know was when you work in a big law firm in New York, you work day and night. So that made the choice for me. But then I was fortunate enough to become a federal prosecutor and chief of white-collar prosecutions, and that was extremely interesting. And then I needed to make a little money, so I became a partner at two large law firms and did white-collar defense, and that was also extremely interesting. And then I, after about 25 years, I thought, you know, this is very tiring. I should take a soft, cushy job. So I became a federal judge. So that's the story.
Let me ask, because one thing you said just piqued my curiosity, and I didn't know this, was you went from prosecuting white-collar crime to defending white-collar crime. Tell me just a little bit about that.
I think that it was one of the things that made me a better judge. Too many times the judges in the United States have been just in one position. If they were in the criminal law, they were either most often prosecutors for their entire career before they became a judge, or occasionally defense lawyers. And similarly, and if they're civil judges, they were just intellectual property experts or securities law experts or whatever. Very narrow. And judges are called on to have a balanced and broad view. And so I consider it very fortunate that I was on both the prosecution side and the defense side, because it sensitized me that there's something to be said for both sides of the coin.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the judge is, that's where he's supposed to sit, right, is in that neutral
exactly.
position.
Exactly.
Any responses to my introduction, especially that part where I say that, like so many systems in the United States, the man on the street or the woman on the street will tell you we've got the best there is, and yet we don't. And yet it seems to me the legal system is one that gets questioned much less.
Yes, I thought that was a very acute point. And when I went on the bench, I thought we had the best system in the world. It was only after a decade or so of seeing things happen in the legal system, sometimes in my own court, that I couldn't prevent, that I began to realize how deficient our system was. The most obvious one being mass incarceration. You know, there was a time the United States led the world in automobiles or steel or whatever. Now we only lead the world in one thing: the number of people we keep in prison, the number of people we incarcerate. 2 million people a year, and that's been more or less stable for the last 20 years. It was not always so. Up until 1970, the United States typically incarcerated much fewer people than many countries. And in absolute terms, it ranged from between 500,000 and 700,000. What caused the change were laws that were passed in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s in response to great increases in the crime rate. And it's natural when crime rate increases that people will vote for politicians who want a tougher position. And so not only in Congress, but in most of the state legislatures, three kinds of laws were passed. One were mandatory minimum, where regardless of the circumstances, whether the guy was a kingpin or a small fry, if he was involved, for example, in drug crimes, the judge would be forced to give him substantial prison time, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. If a gun was involved, it might be as high as 45 years. And then the second kind of law was three strikes and you're out, career offender laws, where if you committed even three fairly low-level, non-violent felonies, you went to prison for life. And again, the judge had no power to stop that. The judge had to impose that sentence. And the third kind of law were sentencing guidelines, which were originally for their first 15 years in the federal system mandatory, and which were supposed to just minimize disparities between individual judges. But in fact, Congress and the state legislatures kept raising the guidelines so that the guidelines became another source of very harsh sentencing. And although now the guidelines are discretionary rather than mandatory, mandatory minimums and career offenders are still mandatory. And that has been the primary driver of this huge increase in the number of people incarcerated. Ironically, beginning in 1996, crime rates began to decline. And for every year up till 2020, they steadily declined to levels that we had not seen since the early 1960s. But the incarceration rate remained the same, because we were locking up ever higher percentage of people who were accused of crime for ever longer periods of time. And the last thing I would mention, just while we're on the subject of mass incarceration, is that there is a clear racial aspect to this. 60% of that 2 million are young Black and Hispanic males between the ages of 18 and 34. They are being ripped from their communities, being ripped from their families, with devastating effects on them, their families, and their communities, even though statistics show that just by nature alone, they will become much less involved in criminal activity over the years. So there's no need to lock them up for these long period of times, but we do.
Okay, let me add, I'm going to add some numbers, a few more numbers to what you said, just because sometimes numbers stick in people's heads. First of all, that increase to the 2.2 million, which are incarcerated in U.S. jails and prisons now, is a 500% increase over 40 years. And the one that really struck me was that because of these three strikes and you're out and these mandatory minimums and so on, one in nine persons in prison is now serving a life sentence.
Yeah.
I think that would shock, you know, everyone. And then, as you say, 40%, 840,000, 40% of the 2.2 million are African-American males, and that means one in nine African-American males between the ages of 20 and 34 is now in prison. One in nine, with at least an equal number subject to probationary supervision. And if current rates hold, one third of all black men will be imprisoned at some point in their lifetimes. And then, as you point out, 20%, 440,000 are young Hispanic males. Just again, it follows so much that we sort of assume and know, but still shocking. One thing I would like to do, Jed Rakoff, is talk about a couple of things that aren't in the book, because I found them fascinating as I went through your biography. Okay, so we set it up with that. Now we'll jump away and then we'll come back to it. Okay, one was that you sort of achieve some notoriety, some public notice, when you rejected a settlement that had been negotiated with Citigroup. And can you talk to us a little bit about that decision? That was
sure.
2011, right? So it's soon. It's one. You were actually one of the people that was sort of saying, "Wait a minute, Wall Street has to pay for what they did."
So, the common approach of most judges, including myself in the early years, was if the SEC proposed to settle with a company that had been accused of often very substantial fraud with very substantial deleterious effects on our economy and on individuals, the judges just rubber stamped the signed off on the settlement. The parties have settled. That's good enough for me. Even before the Citigroup, I had a case involving Bank of America, where the facts were that Bank of America had acquired Merrill Lynch in 2008 at the height of the crisis after the collapse of the mortgage-backed securities market, and had been able to do that by secretly cutting a deal that the executives of Merrill Lynch and some other employees would secretly be paid bonuses of up to $5 billion, even though they had just presided over the worst losses in Merrill Lynch's entire history. And that was all kept secret. And there were a lot of other things kept secret as well. And this was a case of Bank of America's own high-level executives defrauding their own shareholders by not telling them about these secret deals. And the SEC, having exposed all that, they, to their credit, they were the ones who uncovered all that, came to me with a settlement whereby no individuals would pay anything, including the individuals who had orchestrated this, and the company would pay $30 million. You're right to laugh. And by the way, that money was coming from the shareholders
who
were totally innocent. So I rejected that settlement, and the parties caved. Maybe that may be... Too uncautious, because
yeah.
Along came Citigroup. Citigroup was not quite as raw, but it was pretty raw. What they did, again in connection, this was before the collapse of the market, is they took really junk mortgages, so-called liar's loans, as they were called.
Mm-hmm.
And pretended that they were very acceptable first-rate mortgages, and they packaged them together, and they then sold portions of the package, tranches as they were called, to various institutional investors and the like, without revealing just how terrible and lousy these mortgages really were. And of course, once the mortgages all ultimately collapsed, the victims were left with billions of dollars of losses. So that's presented to me in a again, the SEC, to its credit, had unearthed the facts, and they said, this time we're going to be bigger, we're going to charge a few hundred thousand dollars to Citigroup for these huge billion-dollar losses. And they also, which has long been a unfortunate SEC policy, said that Citigroup did not have to admit anything.
I know.
I saw that, and emboldened, I guess, by my Bank of America case, I vetoed that settlement as well. This was too much. And both Citigroup and the SEC went up on appeal and convinced the Court of Appeals that it was their business and none of my business. And so I was reversed. However, I will say that since that time, an increasing number of my fellow judges have given much more attention to these settlements than any of us used to. So at least I take some small solace in that.
I remember when you did this very clearly. If we look back now, I think we could say that one of the things that led to a great deal of, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of just a loss of faith in the system, or a greater loss of faith in the system among so many. And I would say paved the way for Trump and that sort of populism, is that none of the big individual winners were prosecuted, and that Obama went with his let's move forward philosophy. And so when in 2011 you took a stand against this Citigroup one, I remember, quite noting that. And so, as you say, even though you were reversed, it may have woken some people up.
So I think a corollary problem has been the total change in the attitude of the Department of Justice. And this goes back before Trump, before even Obama, but they all carried it out, from prosecuting high-level executives for criminal actions to instead just going after the companies for financial settlements. So back when I had the privilege of being the head of white-collar prosecutions in the Southern District of New York, the Justice Department's philosophy and orders really were to go after the highest level executive that you could prove beyond a reasonable doubt had committed a meaningful financial fraud. And it was because of that that people like the CEO of WorldCom, the CEO of Enron, the CEO of Tyco, the CEO of Adelphia, and many, many others were all successfully prosecuted and went to prison. And I always thought that was right because they were the people who helped orchestrate these huge frauds. Beginning around 2005, 2006, there was a change, and it was a change made primarily for practical reasons of saving resources. It is much, much easier under the law to prosecute a company than to prosecute an individual. Under federal law, the crimes of even the janitor are imputed to the company. So the company has no real choice but to settle. Whereas going after high-level executives requires typically 2 or 3 years of very hard work. It's no different from the way you make cases against drug kingpins or mobsters. You start at the low level mm-hmm. and you flip people and you move up to higher levels. That requires a lot of resources, a lot of time, and you're never sure, of course, at the outset whether you'll succeed or not. And so it became the Justice Department policy, let's not waste all those resources. We could just go after the company. That'll take us a few months at most, they'll pay a nice big fine, and we'll have a nice big press conference in which we trumpet that today we prosecuted this company or that company, and then we'll move on. To my mind, that is doubly wrong. It's wrong in a secondary degree because the people paying the fines of the shareholders who typically have nothing to do with the crime. But it's primarily wrong because it is often the high executives who orchestrated the criminal activity, and why should they not be prosecuted? It is really just an example of we have one law for the poor, we treat them very harshly, hence mass incarceration, and we have another law for the rich, and it's a very lenient and over-forgiving one.
Yeah, and it seems to me the other thing that you haven't mentioned is that if there were a deterrent effect to these prosecutions, that when we prosecute the corporation, it seems to me, you know, you deal with this all the time, but it seems to me we usually get some money, very often no admission of guilt, and the fine is a cost of doing business, which, as you point out, will be borne by the shareholders, and then ultimately by the customer if it's passed on as a business expense. And so in terms of deterrent, a CEO or even a, you know, top financial officer who goes to prison, that seems to me would have an effect.
Yes, and I agree with that entirely. And I don't think you need a lot of prison time to have a deterrent effect. Most, you know, for a white collar executive, even, you know, 6 months or a year in jail is such shock to their, not only to the way they view themselves, but to the way others similarly situated view themselves. So that has a meaningful deterrent effect. Whereas in terms of fines, it's usually, as you say, just the cost of doing business and not as great as the profits that were made from the crime.
In almost every case, yeah.
And yes, and indeed, there's been a study, several studies of this by Professor Brandon Garrett of Duke Law School, where he has shown in great detail that there's a high recidivism rate on the part of many companies who commit these crimes, but are only prosecuted through these corporate deals. And then 2 years later, they're back doing further criminal activity.
Well, you point out that Pfizer faced four deferred prosecution agreements, which means they just went back and back and back. And my guess, and this is kind of just really off the top of my head, is that once you've been caught once, and you get off this easily? It seems to me it's even easier to do it than it was the first time.
Well, I don't know about that, but certainly it's not a deterrent. And
and
Pfizer, of course, has done wonderful things in connection with its vaccine.
Yeah.
But it is does have a history of recidivism so far as criminal activity is concerned.
Right. It's a serial offender. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Jed Rakoff, federal district judge for the Southern District of New York, about his new book, Why the Innocent Plead Guilty and the Guilty Go Free. You can learn more and order the book at, here's a website if you're ready to write, bit.ly/Rakoff, R-A-K-O-F-F, book. Rakoff book is one word, so it's bit.ly/Rakoff book. The other thing, and what I'm realizing is,
I wish my parents had named me Rakoff book. That would have been great. anyway, go ahead.
What I was going to say is that I said these questions were not in the book, but what's true is it all is so connected. And the same thing is that we cover a chapter of your book in these things that I thought were tangents. But here's the other one. You have written about the fact that your older brother's murder, and you've written about his murder in the context of your personal evolving feelings and judgments regarding the death penalty. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, there was, frankly, for many years I couldn't talk about it, but I can now. My older brother, who was a very, very brilliant educator, was gay, was murdered in the Philippines at the age of 45 by a male prostitute. They had a big fight over how much money was due for services, and the prostitute picked up a lamp and bludgeoned my brother to death. And if you had asked me then, should my brother's murderer get the death penalty, I would have said yes. And for reasons I'll get to in a minute, I am now an opponent of the death penalty. But I think it's important to realize that people who favor the death penalty are not just, people who are seething for vengeance in a not very palatable way, but often are people who feel the sheer moral outrage of what has occurred to them or their family or their loved ones, or just victims that they read about. So I am sensitive to that side of the coin. What changed my mind, and this only occurred after I became a judge, was the Innocence Projects. Yep. And they revealed through DNA that not just one or two, but dozens and now hundreds of people who had been convicted, often of death penalty or death eligible offenses like murder and rape, were absolutely innocent, not even involved in the crime, and yet had been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt. Their convictions had been affirmed on appeal. Everyone was sure that our legal system had correctly identified them as the murderers, and we were wrong. And that had a mind-boggling effect on me, and I'm sure many, many other people, and made me realize how fallible our legal system is in so many respects. So how can we execute someone and then find out 2 years later that we executed an innocent man? That I couldn't live with, and so I held the death penalty unconstitutional. I knew at the time I did it that the country, or at least the Court of Appeals, was not ready for it. I'd probably be reversed, but I still am absolutely convinced I was right, and I think the country slowly but surely is moving in that direction. I was really gratified to see a few months ago that Virginia, of all places, mm-hmm. which once was the heart of executions, has now banned the death penalty. So there has been progress.
Yeah, I think many people, as I think you say, are moved ultimately by the fact that because of DNA, very often the Innocence Project and other organizations who follow in their footsteps are able to exonerate convictions, as you point out, that were tied up with a bow and appealed, and everything was done, and turns out not the case. And I think the more that 60 Minutes does a feature on that, and that's in the headlines and so on, the more that people realize. And what's interesting is I was listening to the wording of what you said, and that is that you believe the death penalty to be unconstitutional, even though I think there's no doubt in your brother's case that the alleged murderer was the murderer. It was not a case, right? But that doesn't matter.
He was caught fleeing, and he fully confessed in writing within minutes after the crime. But, we can't have one law that says, well, this one we don't have any doubt about, but in every other case we'll have a different law. I mean, the law has to be the same for everyone, and that means, unfortunately, the current law allows the death penalty for innocent people. I wanted to take the liberty of combining two things we've talked about, mm-hmm. mass incarceration and innocent people being convicted, to point out that 10% of the exonerations by the Innocence Project are of people who pled guilty,
right,
to murders or rapes that they never committed. And why was that? Because these same laws that I referred to earlier that created such harsh penalties without the judge having any ability to change them meant that if you go to trial, you are often facing huge penalties that are a sure thing if you're convicted. So even though you're innocent, you have to make a calculation. I still may be convicted. The system is far from perfect. And if I'm convicted, I'll go away for life or even face the death penalty. Whereas if I plead guilty to something I never committed, I may get off with 10 years or 15 years or 20 years. The people in our criminal justice system who are defendants are often people of limited education, of they are cynical about the system from their own experiences, and they make the, in some ways, perfectly rational decision. Even though I'm innocent, I'm not going to take the risk of life imprisonment, so I'll plead guilty.
Right, and I mean, there's two things that kind of come together there. One is plea bargaining, which we will talk about in a second, and the other is some of the problems with eyewitness ID and forensic science. But one note that I made again at the very top of the show, I wanted you to just lay it out for us, and then we'll jump into both of those. And that is, I quoted you as saying that the criminal justice system in the U.S. bears little relationship to what the founding fathers contemplated, what the media portrays, and what the average American believes. Can you just nail each one of those as to, you know, how far off we are, beginning with...
Yeah,
go ahead.
The founding fathers of the Constitution, clearly sets this forth, thought that criminal matters would be decided through a jury trial. And moreover, a jury trial in which there would be protections, the presumption of innocence, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and so forth. Jury trials in criminal cases are now only 3% of all felony cases in the United States, a tiny, tiny fraction. And that grew out of these same conditions I mentioned previously. We can discuss that more in a minute. But 97% of criminal cases are plea bargained, which is something that didn't even exist at the time the Constitution was put in place. With respect to public...
The media and the public.
Yeah. They until quite recently, took a sort of short-term view of the criminal justice system. Joe was shot dead. Terrible crime. Why hasn't the FBI or the local police caught his murderer? Okay, now they have. There was a case in New York that you're probably familiar with, the so-called Central Park Five, a vicious rape. The police were under huge pressure from the public and from the media to find the perpetrators. So eventually they got five young kids to confess, all of whom were ultimately exonerated. They were false confessions. And until very recently, all you heard about was the crime and the conviction, and you felt good. Okay, they caught the bad guy, and at least some justice is being done. And the third thing, of course, is politics plays a role. Mm-hmm. And while federal judges are appointed and have life tenure, in most states, in 37 of the 50 states, judges are elected. In all 50 states, the district attorneys are elected. And, you know, law and order, lock them up, is usually good politics. One of the reasons it's good politics is because the public never sees both sides of the story. They know that this terrible crime was committed, and they know that Joe Schmo has been indicted for that. They don't know anything about the specific facts or even about the background of Joe Schmo, who may be coming from a terrible background, have severe mental disabilities, and have all sorts of problems that need to be dealt with. But that's not part of what the public sees. And so if the politician or the judge or the district attorney wants to be reelected, they have to get tough on crime, as they say. And there have been studies that show, for example, that elected judges increase their sentences by as much as 25% on average in the 2 years before their reelection campaign.
Wow. And the one other one that was in there was the media. And it seems to me, when you talk about the media portraying our justice system, on the one hand, it's the press, the tabloid press, the folks who are out for, you know, that led sort of the charge in New York against those five. You know, we got to find the perpetrator and so on. That's always the case. What about the way that television has portrayed the court system?
Well, of course, there are many, many programs that take advantage of the fact that the criminal justice system in particular makes for good drama.
Drama, exactly.
And so you have all these television programs, Law and Order and so forth, many of which are extremely well done.
Exactly.
But they, the public doesn't understand that that's not the real system. That's just good drama.
Yep, yep. Yeah, I know it's got, I mean, I was a screenwriter. It's got stakes, it's got adversaries, you know, it's great. So let's talk about some of the errors that happen. Well, first, let's set up just, we touched on it, and in plea bargaining, we're going to touch on plea bargaining just a little bit more. What you've pointed out, and I think when you said only 3% go to trial, that's federal, but it's that low or lower in states, right?
So yeah, basically, that's correct.
It's but about. I was going to say, I think the way for people to really hear that number is that 97% don't.
Right, and this again was not true in the federal system up until 1980, about 20% went to trial, and in the state system, about 25% went to trial. So there's still benefits to plea bargaining, but it was not coerced in the way it is now. And another aspect of it was when cases go to trial, that's the one place where the entire system is put on trial, and everyone sees that were those police techniques fair? Is that a witness really reliable? Is the evidence is being introduced shoddy or sensible, etc., etc. That if you don't have trials, the system becomes, in effect, a secret system.
And Jefferson, one of our founding heroes, he saw the danger in that, as you point out, right?
He famously said, and the exact quote is in my book, but from memory, it's the effect that the jury system is one of the greatest of all protections against abuse by the legal system.
And the other thing that you point out in the plea bargain system, because I think people have seen a bit of that on TV. Okay, so we talked about one of the things that drives it is the mandatory minimum and the three strikes. So that the defendant can look and see, if I lose, I know what I'm going to get. There's no discretion for the judge in this case. I know what I'm going to get. It's really harsh. I don't have the resources to hire a good lawyer. I'm gonna take the plea bargain. But it's something you point out is that it has become a system that is both secret, as we pointed out, but really run by the prosecutor.
Totally. So judges are not allowed to be involved in plea bargaining in the federal system. There's an absolute ban. And in many states, that ban also exists, though there are some exceptions. So what happens is, if you're a defense counsel, as I was for 15 years, you go over and to see the prosecutor after your guy has been arrested and indicted, and let's say he's facing a mandatory minimum of 20 years, and you say, you know, this is my guy says he's innocent, but even if he were guilty, he's a low level guy compared to most of the people you've named. Can't you do something for him? And the prosecutor, there's wide variation among prosecutors. Some will say, okay, I'll give you a 5-year count. Some will say, I'll only give you a 10-year count. But in either case, they will say, and you got to tell me whether you're going to accept it in 2 to 3 weeks, because what's in it for me, the prosecutor, is to get rid of this small fry so I can move more of my energies against the kingpin. So you go back to your client and you say to your client, now, if you're innocent, I will spend every moment trying to prove your innocence. And he will then say, well, that's great, but what do you think are my chances at trial? And every reputable criminal defense lawyer will say, in response to that question, well, I can't really tell you because the system is far from perfect and it makes mistakes. And we know now, to a degree we didn't know 20 or 30 years ago, how often it does make mistakes. So I cannot really give you a guarantee or anything like a guarantee. You have a, if you're innocent and we can prove it, that will be, you will have a substantial chance, but even then you may get convicted. And then the guy will say to you, well, and how much am I facing? Well, if you're convicted, the judge will have to give you 20 years. And under the guidelines, he may give you as much as 30 years. And at that point, the guy, and I'm compressing, of course, what are many conversations, but the guy will say to you, well, maybe I was a little bit guilty. And maybe, you know, half the time he'll be telling the truth and half the time he'll be lying, and you will never know, even as his counsel, which it is. So that's why the power all lies with the prosecutor.
And as you point out, the prosecutor knows, has right in front of him what the mandatories are and what the guidelines are. And the guidelines, I don't think we talked about them much. I'm going to paraphrase it very quickly so we can move past it. But Congress set up guidelines which were supposed to be just that, but they've become almost as adhered to as the mandatories, right?
It's actually a little more for the first 15 years Congress made them mandatory. It was only when the Supreme Court said they can't be mandatory that they were changed to discretionary. But in the meantime, most young judges have never experienced anything but the guidelines, so they might as well be mandatory for young judges because they don't know anything else.
Right. Okay, now, and what you say is that the prosecutor looks at the case, looks at the defendant, looks at, and basically designs his indictment to get the result he wants, and that this all happens in secret, and that the prosecutor basically, by, I'm going to charge you with this rather than that, can that's how the plea bargain becomes, has all the power it has. So it's all in the hands of the prosecutor. What I want to go to also now is we've talked about people being exonerated as innocent. You served on the National Commission on Forensic Science and co-chair of the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Eyewitness ID. Problems with eyewitness ID and problems with forensic science.
So one of the reasons people plea bargain and are, even if they're innocent, is because they now know, and their lawyers now know, how fragile going to trial can be in terms of the evidence. So I mentioned that the Innocence Project, in its several hundred exonerations, 10% pled guilty. The other 90% did go to trial and were convicted and were actually innocent. And it wasn't proven until much later. And they, after they had spent decades in prison, and in many cases were on death row. And the figures more nationally are that about 2,400 people have been exonerated. And again, the great majority of those did go to trial because they thought they were innocent, as they were, and they got convicted anyway. And there are several reasons for that, but I'll mention two in particular. The first is bad forensic science. DNA is forensic science, and it's very good science, but most forensic science, like bite marks and shoe marks and blood spatter marks and things like that, were originally just developed by the police, not by scientists, as a way of sort of getting leads. And, fine, if that can help you get some leads, that's great. But then they began being introduced in the 1920s into the courts, and they've taken on a life of themselves. And just to give you the most extreme example, it was widely believed that hair was as individualized as fingerprints. And so that an expert could look at the hair that was found at the scene of the crime and compare it with the hair of the suspect and could determine, the phrase always was, to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, that the hair came from the same person and from no one else. And that is not scientifically supported in the slightest, but it led to many, many wrongful convictions. Finally, the FBI, again to its credit, although quite late in the game, did a study of the 3,000 cases where its own experts had given testimony like that about this being a perfect match of the hair. And they concluded that in 95% of those cases, their own experts were either wrong or had materially overstated the certainty of their conclusions. 95%. It takes a lot to shock me these days, but that was shocking, shocking to even me. By the way, the cure, which the National Academy of Science suggested, which would be an easy cure, would be to create a National Institute of Forensic Science so that the standards for this would not be set by local police labs or the like, but set by a national institute composed of hard scientists, but that has never taken off because it's opposed by the police labs and the police more generally, as well as other
Now,
groups.
by the way, that strikes me as shocking that that doesn't already exist. You know?
Exactly. And this was suggested by the National Academy in 2009. There's an even bigger problem, and it's a harder one to deal with, which is inaccurate eyewitness
Wow, yes.
identification. And this was present in 70% of the exonerations found by the Innocence Project, and about 30 to 40% of the exonerations found by the National Academy, National Registry of Exonerations, the broader group. And of course, this is always very powerful evidence. Someone who has no motive to lie, a passerby who saw the crime, comes and says, "Yes, I'll never forget that face. It's the defendant right there pointing him out." But in fact, that it is very often wrong. Now, sometimes it's wrong for reasons that the everyday person can understand, like bad lighting or bad vision or whatever. If you saw the great film, My Cousin Vinny, there are lots of examples in that film of good cross-examination about bad eyewitness identification. But unfortunately, there are other causes that are much more subtle and that the average person isn't even aware of. And I'll just mention two. One is the racial effect. People of one race are much better at perceiving the fine facial features of people of their own race than people of other races. And that's true for whites and blacks and Chinese and so forth. Many, many studies have validated this. And so someone who is white who sees someone black will not have the same memory of the face that they would if the person was white, and vice
The
versa.
same level of
And this,
discernment. Yeah.
exactly,
Yeah, it'll be
exactly.
much
And
more
the set,
imprecise. Yeah.
but they will still be quite confident.
Yes.
And one of the reasons they will be confident is the second factor, which is the tendency of memories to merge. So you see a crime being committed. If one could take a photograph of your brain at that point, you would see that you only had a vague perception of the face. But then 3 hours later, you're shown a photo array, and you're a good conscientious citizen, and you want to make sure you study the photo array carefully. So you study it for maybe an hour, and finally you say to the policeman, "Well, I'm not totally sure, but I think number two is the one that's most like the guy that I saw commit the crime. Now, number two in the photograph has a scar above his right eyebrow. Actually, you didn't notice that when you first saw the crime being committed. But by the time you come to trial a year later, or even when you just go to see the prosecutor who is preparing for a plea bargain 3 months later, those two memories will have merged. And you will say to the prosecutor or the jury, I am absolutely sure it's this guy, because I will never forget the scar above his wow. right eyebrow. And you won't be consciously lying. It's because the brain has merged those two memories together, which the brain unfortunately tends to do.
Yeah. And the third thing I know, and there's probably more, but one other thing is that the police can nudge you in one direction or another to help you with your identification and your certainty.
Yes, that's true, but that is the one most curable. That could easily be cured by having all lineups and photo arrays conducted by policemen who had no part in the underlying investigation.
Right.
Curing some of the other problems that are more deeply seated in the human memory and perception are much harder to deal with.
Much harder. And what's happened is we've accepted them. And this learning curve of us learning that what we thought was reliable, what we saw in Perry Mason was reliable, what we saw on Law and Order was reliable, is not reliable. And to unlearn that confidence is a big deal. We've got to wrap this up, Jed Rakoff. If I gave you a minute to sort of say why you wrote the book and what you hope happens, take it away.
I wrote the book even though for a long while I didn't think judges should be speaking out the way I now am, because I just saw so many serious deficiencies in our legal system. We've talked about in the criminal system, we could go on for another hour about the civil system.
Absolutely.
And it just got to me after a while. And so I wrote this book in the hope that it would help educate the public about these deficiencies, because it was coming from someone who saw it in his own court.
And what we know is that, as I said in the introduction, this is not a system that most Americans pay much attention to. And so to at least put this forward, I care about this topic, and I have seen way too few books written about it, just from that standpoint, you know? So again, the book is Why the Innocent Plead Guilty and the Guilty Go Free, and you can learn more and order the book at this website, bit.ly/Rakoff Book. That's bit.ly/Rakoff Book, one word, RAKOFF, and the word book. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, plus links to 8 or 10 articles I choose each week, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most other podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site, and you can listen anytime, anywhere. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Jed Rakoff. Keep up your good work.
My pleasure.